Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't know if everybody has heard, but about 10 minutes ago, Apple announced that Steve Jobs died today. And so I have to tell you that I don't think it's appropriate nor probably the best thing to do for any of us to necessarily be focusing on Facebook marketing right now. And so I am going to talk about Steve Jobs and Apple and what Steve has meant to me, what Steve has meant to the industry, and personal computing, and just the internet and everything, if you don't mind, rather than talking about Facebook marketing. And I hope that is okay with all of you. This announcement, I mean, literally happened as we were prepping and getting all our things together for the conference that we're now attending. So it could not have happened at a more with less notice to us. So I hope it's okay with you that I'm going to switch topics completely. And my phone, my cell phone, and my other phone is just ringing off the hook with people trying to get quotes from me. But I'm going to do this webinar instead. So here's the story. So I joined Apple in 1983. My path to Apple was that I interviewed for a job with Apple the first time in order to work what was called in the Apple University Consortium. And the Apple University Consortium was Steve Jobs' vision that the place to seed Macintoshes would be universities. At the time, K through 12 was pretty much dominated by the Apple II, and so he saw that the next level of computing would be, of course, colleges. So he created a program. It was headed by a guy named Daniel Lewin, whose charter was, or its charter was, to convince universities to use Macintoshes, and it started with places like Carnegie Mellon and Stanford. So the first job I interviewed was to work in that group. And I don't know, it just wasn't a good fit for me. So about 6 months went by, and then the second job that I interviewed for at Apple was to be software evangelist. And a software evangelist job was to meet with software and hardware companies and convince them to do Macintosh products. And so that's the job that I took, the second job that I tried for at Apple. And if you really want to know the inside story, The reason why I got that job is because my college classmate, Mike Boych, was working in the Mac division. And so he hired me because we knew each other. We were friends. So one could say that it was purely nepotism. So let's talk about the Macintosh division. The Macintosh division, I think, was probably the greatest collection of egomaniacs in the history of California. And that is saying a lot, believe me. So, The closest thing I can say to describing what it's like to work there, you know how after the Super Bowl, there's a TV camera on the winning quarterback, and the TV camera says, "Where are you going to go now?" You know, to the quarterback, and the quarterback says, "I'm going to Disneyland." Well, working in the Macintosh division in the mid '80s was like working at Disneyland, or more accurately, being paid to go to Disneyland. Basically, the division was on a mission from Steve, as opposed to God. And this mission from Steve was that, you know, we wanted to prevent worldwide domination of information and freedom from IBM. So we looked at IBM as the enemy. This was the whole point of the 1984 commercial, that if IBM ruled the world, it would be boring, totalitarian, George Orwellian, just an ugly society of mediocrity and conformity and thought control. And Apple was going to send the proverbial axe into the image of Big Brother. And so it was religious fervor. In the sense that we were fighting a mighty opposite, which was IBM, the totalitarian mainframe company. And so we were, I'd say about 50 people. We had a building on Banley Drive, and actually not badly, it was Mariani. And this is a building. There's a story about how someone put a pirate flag above the building. That's true. Steve Capps, the person who wrote The Finder, got a pirate flag and put it up there because we were going to be pirates, and not the establishment. And this was Steve's division. And what we did is we worked very, very hard because we truly thought we were on a mission to improve people's creativity and productivity and to prevent totalitarianism, primarily of IBM. The group was a very interesting collection of people. There were people like me who, had MBAs, and I was hired despite having an MBA. There were people like Burl Smith, who Steve found working in an Apple II repair department. Andy Hertzfeld, who wrote much of the Macintosh ROMs, was no one was old at the time, but an experienced Apple II programmer. It was a collection of just great software and hardware engineers. There were artists like Susan Kerr, who created much of the early graphics and icons of Macintosh. Joanna Hoffman was the first person who was the marketing, who did the marketing function for the division. Mike Boych, as I said, who I work for, he and I went to Stanford together. He went to HP, the calculator division of HP in Corvallis, and he was recruited out of there. The person who recruited him was a guy named Mike Murray. Mike Murray was the director of marketing of the Macintosh division. Subsequently to Macintosh, he went to work for Apple. Excuse me, for Apple. He went to work for Microsoft, and he became Microsoft's VP of HR. So it was a merry band of pirates. Steve himself had only attended one semester of Reed College in Oregon. So here we were, on paper, not so qualified. We had a few PhDs. One person was Bruce Horn. He was a PhD student from, I believe, Carnegie Mellon. He was the co-author of The Finder with Steve Capps. And so it was a great place to work because, man, we were going to change freaking history. And I can't tell you how euphoric it was to work there, because it was such bright people and we had such a mission to change the world. So that was the Macintosh division. I guess one of the high points of that division. Man, I gotta shut this phone here. I'm gonna put my phone on airport mode because I'm getting so many calls that even Vibrate is bugging me right now. One second here. Okay, now we are in airport, so no one can call me. So this was the division. Some aspects of the division that you might find interesting. Steve bought the division a Bösendorfer grand piano, and some of the people played Bösendorfer grand piano. There was a BMW motorcycle for the division. We also had a travel policy that any flight over 2 hours qualified for first class. I tended to interpret that rule as the 2 hours begins at the moment you leave your apartment. So I lived in Los Altos. Los Altos to SFO, can be 45 minutes or so. So I basically flew first class everywhere. It was a great time. Across the street was the Lisa division. The Lisa division was creating basically a very large Macintosh, but it was $7,000, a big footprint. Arguably, the Lisa taught us many lessons that we applied to the Macintosh and made Macintosh successful. A social media analogy would be that Google Buzz is to Google Plus what Lisa is to Macintosh, if you can wrap your mind around that analogy. So that was the Macintosh division. Macintosh was announced on January 24th, 1984 in De Anza College, where Steve unveiled it. At the time, he was not wearing a black mock turtleneck. Back then, his thing was a double-breasted suit with a bow tie. So he introduced it, and that was one of the most enchanting moments of my life, to watch Macintosh be introduced by Steve Jobs. The first time I saw a Macintosh was in the back of that building, the Macintosh division building. At the time, I was in the jewelry business, and my friend Mike Boyd showed me a Macintosh, and I was an Apple II user, and that was a religious experience also, because back then, you know, with an Apple II, you were fortunate if you had a 24x80 terminal screen. You moved the cursor around with cursor keys. Graphics was using X's and O's to, you know, draw things. This is the first time you saw Mac write with multiple fonts and multiple sizes, multiple styles, integration of text and graphics. And the first time you saw Mac paint with graphics, paint cans, brushes, it was a magical experience. So what happened after that was we had a very successful launch. The goal was to sell 250,000 Macintoshes in the first 100 days, and we achieved that goal. You know, back then, the whole thing with Macintosh and developers were we told them three stories. You know, it was a very rich technical environment, you know, this great programming environment, very rich ROM set. We told them that it was also a good financial bet because we were going to bring people to personal computing who could never use a personal computer before. And finally, it was a good hedge, because at the time the IBM personal computer division was starting to publish software. So we were explaining to people if IBM started publishing software in your segment under their own label, you would be dead. And so that was our evangelism pitch. I think mostly people, what appealed to developers was the richness of the Macintosh programming environment. That, you know, back then the decision was being made by engineers and nerds, not MBAs and marketing people. So that's what really sucked people in. It was very, very interesting, albeit challenging, programming environment. So, you know, now we're in mid-1984. Things are going pretty good. You know, we're selling a lot of Macs. Has that post-launch glow. Sort of hit the wall because businesses were not embracing Macintoshes. It didn't have some crucial pieces of software, thanks to me. It was slow in a lot of operations. It took us a good 2 years to significantly revise that product. I think mostly because we were so tired from shipping it at all. And after that, you know, there was what I call the wonder years. Is I wonder when there will be software. I wonder when we'll turn the corner. As businesses were rejecting it, you know, we went through this period of euphoria. Then we went through this period of down in the dumps. This is one of those major times when, according to all the experts, Apple was supposed to die. You know, we brought in some adult supervision, i.e. John Sculley. You know, a lot of interesting things happened. It culminated with some layoffs, culminated with a board decision picking between John Sculley and Steve Jobs, and they picked John Sculley. So Steve Jobs was out. He went and started Next, you know, the big black cube computer built on Unix. And things did not exactly pick up. A few years went by. They made Mike Spindler CEO, and then they made Gilamelio CEO. And Gilamelio decided to buy Next, I think, for, you know, $400 million. Steve came back to Apple first as an advisor, temporary, you know, to help Gil and stuff. And then eventually Gil started imploding, and Steve came back, introduced the iMac. And from there, the rest is kind of history, right? So the iMac, if you remember, it was that teardrop-shaped-looking computer that came in colors like blueberry and cherry and, I don't know, tangerine and stuff. And that sort of the industrial design of that computer, I think, really was sort of what rekindled people's enthusiasm for Macintosh. And, you know, fast forward a few years, and we have things like the iPod and iPhone, an iPad. Macintosh slipped to less than 5% market share. It subsequently has returned. I don't ever know if it'll be more than 10%, but it's definitely on the upswing. I could tell you with total certainty that Steve Jobs was a great, if not the greatest, influence in my life. From him I learned, one is an appreciation of design, an appreciation of elegance and simplicity. I learned how far you can push people, that you can get the best work out of people by pushing them with great challenges. You know, Steve was not exactly a warm and fuzzy kind of guy, but he got the best results out of people. he could drive you crazy because, you know, the trash can icon didn't look right, or, you know, a certain shade of black wasn't black enough. He was heavily influenced by Paul Rand, the logo designer. It's just, you know, I mean, I consider it an honor to have worked for him in the Macintosh division, and only a 100 or so people could say that. So, what a time! What a time! And if you look back, for no matter how you feel about Apple, you have to say that it really started, or you know, was among the starters of the personal computer industry. Definitely made the graphical user interface go mainstream. So if you look at it, Steve Jobs created the, in a sense, Apple I standard, the Apple II standard, the Macintosh standard. Then he created, you know, smartphone standard, iPhone, iPod standard, iPad standard. Lots of companies and people are fortunate to create one revolution, but Steve Jobs arguably created four or five. And I truly do believe that if you look at all the CEOs over the history of business, I don't think there's a CEO who has done more for his employees, his shareholders, and his customers. So the world is a lot worse off without Steve Jobs. I mean, may he rest in peace. But wow, what a job he did for everybody, personally for me, and many, many people who work for the Macintosh division. And I think in many ways, for many of the people who use Apple products, that these Apple products made them more creative, more productive, you know, brought joy and enchantment to their lives. So, I've been going on, rambling on, and for about 20 minutes now. I would love to take questions now from the audience, anything you want. I mean, it can even be about Facebook marketing if you like, but, you know, fire away.
All right. Thanks very much, Guy. And again, so sorry about the loss. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take live questions at this time. If you're dialed into our audio toll-free number, just press *8 on your telephone if you'd like to ask Guy a question. If you're listening to my voice on your computer audio and would like to ask Guy a question, just dial 866-630-3507 and enter PIN 9206. Once dialed in, just press *8 to be placed in the question queue. And I do believe we've got Mr. Mike Stelzner on the line as well, who would like to get a bit of a dialogue going with Guy also. Mike, are you there? Okay, maybe he's not there.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do then is go ahead and post that number here for you guys. Again, if you do have any questions at all, now is the time to dial in and post them to Guy. We'll go ahead and take your questions over the phone.
Jessamine, I'm on the line now.
Fantastic. And everybody, you should see the dial-in number with that orange box on your screen as well if you'd like to ask Guy a live question. Take it away, Mike.
So, Guy, I'm going to just start lobbying some questions at you that just
okay.
come to mind. Some of them are going to be about you. Some of them are going to be about Steve Jobs. I'd like to start with you and the word enchantment. And I know there's a connection between Steve and the word enchantment.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote an entire book about this. Can you kind of share with me and the audience a little bit about that word, what makes Steve enchanting? And let's just start there.
Yeah. Well, I think the basics of enchantment are likeability, trustworthiness, and quality. So you need, you know, elements of all three of those. And what Apple and Steve did is they kind of hit it out of the ballpark, right? I mean, I'm not an Apple employee anymore, and I own exactly one share of stock. I can't even remember how I have one share of stock, but I have one share of stock. And Apple has truly created, like, the most enchanting company. I mean, other computer companies, they promote, they bludgeon, they coupon, they discount, they, you know, rebate, they spiff, they do whatever it takes for you to buy a computer. But Apple enchants you. And when they enchant you, what happens is you embrace their values. These are values such as WYSIWYG, such as thinness, such as, democracy of power and computing. And when you embrace these values, then you become enchanted, and one of the logical consequences of becoming enchanted is, of course, you buy their computer. And once you buy their computer, then you're sliding on down to buying their phone, buying their iPod, buying their iPad. And that's the difference between enchantment and sales. It's sharing this dream. And next thing you know, you're standing in line trying to get the first iPhone in New York City, and you're, it's midnight and they don't open till 8 hours from now.
Guy, obviously back in the days when you were at Apple, there wasn't social media channels available, and we didn't have the power to rally people together to communicate about things, about new products, about the death of important leaders. How back then did you, because I know you were an evangelist for Apple, how did you get people excited about what you guys were doing, and what lessons can people apply today?
Sure. So the major lesson you can take from this is that it is much easier to enchant people with great stuff than with crap. And I've tried it both ways, so I can tell you this from firsthand experience. So one of the beauties of working for the Macintosh division is we had a great product. And so it was, arguably plug it in, give a person a mouse, and it enchants you. You don't have to sell it, right? And so, that's the key. Now, it's kind of a duh-ism. Yeah, of course, duh. You'd rather be selling a great product than a lousy product. But that duh-ism, boy, a lot of people don't get that duh-ism. I call this guy's golden touch, which is not whatever I touch turns to gold. Guy's golden touch is whatever's gold guy touches.
Gotcha.
So you need to touch gold.
So let's say that some of the people listening today happen to have gold.
Yeah.
What do they do? How do they take it from what they have to something that is going, what's the next step?
Well, step number one is always ship. I tell people, and this is a great quote from Steve Jobs, and he says, that real artists ship. So you don't just sit there thinking for years and years, I could do this better. I'm working on this perfect algorithm. I'm doing this. You have to ship. You have to get it out into the marketplace. And you could make the case that that's the difference between Apple and Xerox PARC. The Xerox PARC had many of the ideas for Macintosh, the user interface, all this kind of mouse, all this kind of stuff, but they could not ship. They could not take it mainstream. They didn't think that they were making a computer for the rest of us. They thought they were making a computer for the best of us. And it's a very different market. So one lesson of Steve Jobs is ship. And you could make the case. Another lesson is ship, then test. Because what we shipped surely was not perfect, especially with hindsight.
So you recently shipped a new book that is doing exceptionally well. And I'm just curious if you would share some of the social media techniques that you use to get this book out there, because I know you did some pretty amazing things.
Yeah, and a lot of it was with Facebook. I ran photo contests. I had a reveal scheme where if you liked the page, you would get access to PDFs of my first book, The Macintosh Way, which I wrote right after I left the division, explaining what the Macintosh division was trying to do. So there's that reveal strategy, there's photo contests. I ran a quiz so that people could ascertain how enchanting they were, and then they got scored, and most people scored low, so the quiz said, you better buy the book. What a coincidence, huh? I think today, as an author, in the old days, publishing 1.0, this is how it worked. So the author wrote a book. The author needed help with editing and design. And especially the author needed help with cutting down trees, making them into pulp, then paper, putting ink on the paper, binding the paper, putting a cover on it, and shipping it to a bookstore. So right. Those are all the things that a publisher did. So today, let's look at the same thing. An author still needs editing. Author still needs design. The question is, does the author need to ship boxes of dead trees to bookstores? And, you know, I may not like it, but I have to say that there are fewer and fewer bookstores to ship the boxes of dead trees to. And, you know, of course, this comes right full back to Steve, which is his vision for iPad. I mean, I would say that iPad is probably going to have more effect upon society than Macintosh, because I think iPad changes the information consumption of more people at a much lower price point. So it's going to fundamentally change the information dissemination. And
so you got all these people out there with iPhones and iPads and all these mobile devices, right, that are carrying around Facebook and all these social networks, Guy. And I would imagine, you made the conscious decision, I recall, when you launched this book to pretty much have your Facebook page be the place
yes.
where people went. Can you talk a little bit about why you made that
yes.
decision and what the response was?
So I looked at Facebook, and my calculation was this, that there were at the time, I don't know, 700 million people on Facebook. So I looked at that. I said, well, 700 million people, that's, you know, roughly third in the world behind China and India. So basically everybody who probably will buy the book is on Facebook. So rather than trying to send them to a website, it's much easier to send them to a Facebook fan page. Facebook fan page has some very big advantages, such as liking and sharing. And I also think that, you know, at your own web page, people do all kinds of stupid comments, porn, you know, spam, whatever. But on sure. Facebook, because it's much more likely that you are who you are because of you went through the Facebook, you know, vetting process, that I think Facebook, when you're on Facebook, the comments are much more intelligent, constructive, and cogent. There's also the ability to post and share pictures. So there's a lot of things that are built into the Facebook system that make it a very good marketing platform. So I decided, using Facebook apps and, you know, HyperArts, and I used a company out of Vancouver named Strutta to do the photo contest and stuff, that I would make the center of my marketing a Facebook fan page.
Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, you know, it was successful. For many people, sending people to a Facebook fan page is no different than sending them to a standalone website. You know, there are some things you cannot do on a Facebook fan page. However, there are many things that come for free, such as commenting and photos and video and all that kind of stuff. So I think it was very successful. But having said that, I will tell you that several weeks after I did my Facebook fan page, I decided that I was not reaching everybody, and that, you know, there are 800 million people on Facebook, but there's also another 4 billion people who are not. And so what I did is, after Facebook, I did create a standalone web page that had basically a duplication of all the information.
So the take-home message there is that even though Facebook is the biggest social network in the world, you shouldn't necessarily rely 100% on it for the marketing of whatever you do. Is that what I hear you saying?
Absolutely, and I'll give you a very illustrative point. So I have this quiz that I talked about where you determine how enchanting you are.
Right.
So I thought, you know, everybody's going to do it there. And this is me pushing this everywhere, okay? So then about 4 weeks later, I did a standalone website version. And then about 4 weeks after that, I asked the people who were hosting the quiz, which was Wildfire, and I asked the people who created the standalone internet page, Electric Pulp, you know, how many did they do? How many people took the test? And believe it or not, the ratio was 4-1. Now, here's the kicker. It was 4-1 for the website over Facebook.
Interesting.
So 4 times more people took the independent website test than the Facebook quiz. Same quiz. And so that's a very valuable lesson for every marketer out there. You know, don't assume everybody's on Facebook and you can only do Facebook. I don't think it's true. Well, it wasn't true in April of 2011.
Talk to us a little bit about, this is your 10th book. How is this one doing compared to the others?
This one is taking off faster than any of the others, and a lot of that is because, you know, it's that just that many more years of exposure, my exposure, but also I have better tools.
Right.
And the better tools are Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus.
Okay, we've got a couple of folks that want to talk to you and ask you some questions.
Okay,
so we're
going to
take a couple of them, and then I'm going to chime in with some more questions. So, Justin, whenever you want to bring them online.
All right, yeah, we have a few people here in the queue. So thanks, everyone. Again, if you would like to dial in with a live question, please do so. We'll take the first person dialing in from Ann Arbor, Michigan. You may go ahead with your question. Caller from Michigan, you are live on the line. Okay, maybe they are on mute. I'll go ahead and take the
question. Oh, no, I'm sorry about that. Hi, Guy.
Hi.
This is Chris Palmer.
Hi.
I have really enjoyed your site, and I've enjoyed following you on Twitter. I wanted to ask you some questions, a question actually about Steve Jobs.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask what we can learn from him, in your opinion, as a risk taker. For those of us that are doing business-to-business marketing and business-to-business public relations using the social media tools, what kinds of things can we learn from the risks that Steve Jobs took? Because a lot of things that he did didn't work out.
To put it mildly, yes. So this is a very, very simple question, but it has a very complex answer. So bear with me, okay? So number one, some things that I think you absolutely can learn from Steve Jobs is, one, that customers are not very good at telling you what they need. They may be able to tell you what they want, and what they'll tell you is bigger, faster, cheaper, sameness. Bigger, faster, cheaper MS-DOS machine. Bigger, faster, cheaper Apple II. Nobody said, give us a Macintosh with a mouse, with a trash can, with a graphical user interface that integrates text and graphics that has no software. Not one person asked for that. But Steve Jobs, that's what he delivered. Because Steve Jobs was not in the business of, you know, listening to customers, going back to the labs and giving engineers instructions to produce what he was just told by the customers. You know, Apple marketing focus group is an oxymoron. The closest thing to an Apple marketing research project is Steve's left hemisphere would be communicating with Steve's right hemisphere. So, lesson number one is customers cannot tell you how to create a revolution. They can tell you how to evolve something, but not how to do a revolution. Lesson number two is that there are people who care about aesthetics. And, you know, not everybody is price conscious, or price is not the most important variable for everybody. There is a segment of the population who cares. That's why some people buy, you know, higher end cars than lower end cars. And if you try to create a computer that's good for everybody, you'll create a computer that's good for no one. So that's the second lesson. And the third lesson, I think, is that you get your best work from people when you present them with huge challenges that, you know, this wasn't simply about eking out a living. This is about changing the history of mankind by bringing out a great computer that increased people's creativity and productivity. And that's a lot different than saying we're going to build an MS-DOS clone. You know, very different horizon. So that was very important. Now, I need to give you a caveat, though. I don't think that many people should look at Steve Jobs and say, I'm going to be like Steve Jobs and that'll make me as successful as Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs is one and only Steve Jobs. He is truly unique. There is nobody else like Steve Jobs. And so you shouldn't necessarily pattern what he did as a way for you to do things. Of any hero, I mean, Steve is one hero, my hero, and a hero of many other people, but I just think, you know, you shouldn't emulate heroes necessarily, because there's a lot of things have to fall in place for a hero to become a hero. And also, I think a lot of people they have a difficult time separating correlation from causation. And by that I mean, and we'll take a facetious example, you know, so let's say that Steve Jobs wears New Balance tennis shoe, running shoes, and blue jeans and mock black turtlenecks. Okay, this doesn't mean that if we all go out and buy New Balance shoes with blue jeans and black mock turtlenecks that we will be Steve Jobs. Not at all. So as long as you have the caveat that Steve Jobs is a rare individual, and you understand the difference between correlation and causation, but you do keep in mind the lessons of design and anticipation of what customers want and need before they can express it, and that you can get the best work out of people by giving them really big challenges, I think that you can draw a lot of value from Steve Jobs' career.
Thank you very much. That was really very helpful.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for that question as well. We have somebody dialing in, looks like on a cell phone from California. Caller, you are live on the line. You may go ahead with your question.
Hi, Guy.
Hi.
I just had a question in regards to your thoughts on the iOS 5 that's set to release. What kind of social implications do you think that's going to, you know, kind of affect?
You know, to tell you the truth, I am not that familiar with iOS 5. I am an iPod and iPhone user. I have an iPhone 4. I don't know. You know, I have this attitude now that I'm 57 years old. I have this attitude that I don't make myself crazy about rumors of what's going to happen. And you know, I think you saw that to a great deal yesterday, right? So yesterday, there are all kinds of rumors. You know, the iOS, iPhone 5, different form factor, big deep relationship with Facebook, going to change social media, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know where these people were even getting these hallucinations. And then what does Apple announce? iPhone 4S, which is better camera, better chip, more memory, better voice navigation. You know, it was almost not nearly what everybody predicted. So, you know, I have a very pragmatic attitude. I just don't make myself crazy. And when they announce it, I stand in line, I go to the Apple store, and I buy one. I have to tell you that, you know, this is a call about social media and Facebook. And here's a very interesting lesson for both you and Chris, the previous caller, which is if you look at what Apple does with social media, you have to say that Apple is an anti-social company, right? I mean, this is a company that, you know, bloggers write about it and write some secrets and they sue the blogger. This is a company that, you know, somebody, you know, an engineer leaves a phone in a bar and they, you know, they make it into a crime. And this is a company that they tell you absolutely nothing about what's going to happen. Do you know of an Apple fan page that's very popular? Are there, you know, multiple Twitter accounts at Apple Cares or like at Comcast Cares or, so, you know, this is, I don't know how you want to take this, but you could say, well, Apple once again proves that you don't have to listen to the so-called experts. Every expert is saying you need to be social, you need to be transparent, you need to engage with your customers. You'd have to say that Apple is 0 for 3 there. It's antisocial, it doesn't engage, and it's not transparent. It's completely opaque. So, now, this doesn't mean that, okay, so Apple's been very successful by being opaque, antisocial, and standoffish. So that's what we'll be. And we'll be like Apple. Again, you know, it may not work for you like it worked for Apple. So it's complex. I mean, Apple is a very interesting place. So I don't know if I answered your question.
And this, I'm actually going to read a text question that came in via chat that kind of you kind of just addressed. But somebody was asking, why do you think that Apple has not taken advantage of social media outlets like Facebook or Twitter?
Um, I'm going to play amateur psychiatrist for a second, okay?
Perfect.
Okay, so back in the mid-80s, when Apple wasn't doing so well, many, many press people and so-called experts predicted the death of Apple. They said Apple would die. You know, Michael Dell said that Apple should take the cash it has, close down the company, and return the cash to the shareholders. And so if you looked at articles about Apple in the mid-80s, there was kind of a keyboard macro so that when you typed in Apple, it came out the beleaguered Apple. You know, people. I think people started thinking that the formal name of Apple was Beleaguered Apple Computer Inc. And so Apple, several times in its history, has come under such pressure from and such negativity from the press. All the experts, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, Business, Fortune, Forbes, everybody was saying Apple's going to die, okay? So Apple, when it's successful, it remembers those days when everybody was picking on them. And it says, you know, why should I be nice to you now that I'm successful? Because when I was down in the dumps, you were telling everybody not to buy Macintoshes and we were going to die. So you think I'm going to be nice to you now? I don't think so. So that's my explanation.
All right. Fantastic. We still have a lot of questions here.
Okay.
Thank you. So we'll go ahead and take the next person dialing in over the telephone. Thanks for all these questions, by the way, you guys. Looks like this person's dialing in on a cell phone from Tennessee.
All right.
Hello, Guy.
Hi.
This is Lauren McMullen, and I first wanted to just express my condolences to you. I'm sure this was a very difficult call to get ready for. But my question sort of has to do with the last couple of questions.
Okay.
I actually came to Apple, well, I've had an iPhone for several years, but I bought my first Apple computer a year ago and just immediately fell in love and wondered why I didn't do it years before.
Yeah.
Like, where have I been?
You know, I've been wondering about you, too.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Well, I have signed on. But one of the things that I love so much about the whole Apple experience is this idea of, you know, the most beautiful, the most exclusive, the most, you know, the best of the best. And then you have access to the people in their stores, you know, in the genius bars and
Yeah. Stuff
like that, which are, I mean, they'll just take you by the hand and practically Yep. Raise you through this.
Yep.
And that seems really social to me. You know, that's Yep. The sort of the same concept. So I'm wondering whose idea was that?
The Apple Store?
Uh-huh, and that ability to have free access to all those techie people.
You know, I was not in Apple when the Apple Store decision was made. I will tell you that, you know, this is perhaps another illustration of out of the darkness comes light. So if memory serves me right, back then, Apple was a brand that was distributed by big box retailers. So you would go into a big box retailer and there would be a little Apple section. So there'd be a Dell section and an HP section and an Apple section. And I think in Cupertino, we heard story after story of people going into these large department stores and consumer electronics stores, and the Macintoshes weren't turned on, the people didn't know how to use them, they weren't selling well, and blah, blah, blah. So I think at one point, truth be told, the people at Apple and Cupertino just got fed up with how their resellers were handling Macintoshes, and they said, screw it. So if they can't sell it, you know, properly, we'll just create our own Apple store, and we'll sell it by ourselves. And, you know, I think that started a few Apple stores, and lo and behold, if you had a store with only sold Macintoshes, with people who loved and understood Macintoshes and could support Macintoshes, lo and behold, it might be only 5% of the market, but 5% of the market coming into your store was good enough. And so the concept was very quickly proven, and now there's several hundred Apple stores, and I think included one that just opened up in Shanghai. And so this is another great story of, I don't know if Steve made the call, because there were some very bright people doing the Apple retailing, like Alan Olivo. But at some level, at some level, Steve had to have said yes. Because,
mm-hmm.
For a decision this big, I guarantee you he made the call.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the inside, I think the most beautiful Apple store that I've ever been to is the one in Covent Garden in London. If you go inside that store, you just say, wow, you can just feel Steve's design vibes in this store. So what a concept, right? You walk into a store, there's not all that crap all over the place, there's no cash registers, the people know their product, they love their product, you can go talk to a genius, and lo and behold, the person really does know the product, helps you, as you say, holds your hand. So, I said the three components of an enchanting company are likability, trustworthiness, and quality. So quality we understand, right? Likability, extreme likability. Most people in the world don't know Steve Jobs personally. For most people, how do they come to the conclusion that Apple's likable? Apple Store.
Exactly.
And how do they come to the conclusion that Apple is trustworthy? The Genius Bar.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put those three things together, that's what you get, an enchanting company.
Very much so, because in the height of the economic downturn in Tampa, where I went into the store with my mom to get
uh-huh.
my first computer, there were no shortage of people spending lots of money.
Yeah. Well, anybody can spend money when things are booming.
Right.
It's true believers who buy it when things are tough.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that question as well. Before we take another live question, I'll read this text question. Would you say that part of Apple and Steve Jobs' enchantment is their ability to create buzz when they launch a product? How is it that they succeed at this, whereas a lot of other companies don't even come close?
Yeah, you should put a period after don't even period, come period, close period. And believe it or not, I addressed this. There's a whole chapter about presentations in the book. But there's two things, okay? So first, going back to Guy's Golden Touch, you know what? It's very easy to give a great introduction of a great product. So if you want to have a great introduction event, have a great product. If you have crap, it's hard to spin crap into greatness. So that's number one. Kind of a duh-ism, but many people forget that. So, enchantment is not about putting lipstick on a pig. It is about truly having something beautiful. Now, having said that, some tips for you. When you introduce something, you need to tell a story. And this is not a story of we have something that's patent-pending, curve-jumping, paradigm-shifting, enterprise, scalable, secure, whatever buzzword from your IT background you can find. This is telling a story about how, you and your partner, you were frustrated because you couldn't use a computer except at a large company or at a university or at a military institution. So you thought, surely there must be a better way. There must be a way to make computers smaller and cheaper and easier to use. So we started Apple. Tell that story of my girlfriend wanted to sell her Pez dispensers online. There was no way to do it, so we started eBay. That happens to be a bullshit story, but it is a great story. And then so you tell a story, and then you sell your dream. You don't say, this is an iPhone 4. It has $188 worth of parts manufactured in China. You say, this is an iPhone 4. It's thinner. It's faster. It has more apps. It has, it makes you cool. It makes you sexy. It makes you more creative and more productive. This is a dream. This dream is going to make you into a better person, as opposed to $188 worth of parts manufactured in China.
All right. That just made me want to get an iPhone. We will go ahead and take the next person dialing in. Caller, you may go ahead with your question.
Sorry, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi. My name is Mandy Rondon. I'm calling from Puerto Rico.
Wow.
Hi. Yes.
Hi.
Probably the only one online from Puerto Rico. There's not very many of us who are in social media down here. Good evening, Guy. And first of all, I want to express my condolences for the loss of your very good friend and the loss of all of us, I think, in that sense.
Yes.
I wanted to ask a question regarding Facebook, and I was reading the title of the presentation today. It's How to Enchant Customers and Prospects.
Uh-huh.
There are 1.4 million people in Facebook in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
It's not 7 million, but it's a lot for a small island.
How many people are there in Puerto Rico?
Puerto Rico, about 4 million.
Okay.
And there's 1.4 million on Facebook, so it's a pretty big number.
Okay.
But what I'm struggling with here, and what the few of us that are here actually doing it right, I'm not saying that we all got it right, this is something that you have to study and learn day by day, but the ones that are really trying to offer this as a good service for marketing for companies are facing the problem that a lot of people down here are not really sure about how to use this for business or whether they want to use this for business and if it's going to be successful. And the ones that do have the expectancy that this is going to work automatically. Okay, you say today and tomorrow I'm going to have 200 people in my store stat.
Well, I hope you don't believe that. You know, this is a problem only in Puerto Rico.
Okay, so this is more broad than our small little island, I guess.
No, it's in Palo Alto too. It's not just Puerto Rico.
Okay, well, I love social media, and I try to open up my client to using most of the tools, not just Facebook. And one of the things that you said earlier, which I totally agree with, is some of my own clients feel that if I'm on Facebook, I'm in. I mean, that's all I need. That's all I need in marketing. That's all I have to do. And they become a little disillusioned when they realize that, oh, well, this is not going as fast as I wanted to.
Right.
I want something different. How do you stray from what everybody else is doing and you enchant people with what you do, and you find that one different thing that people say, okay, I want to go with you, because everybody else knows how to work with Facebook, but you do this one different thing that works.
Well, wait, when you say that, you're saying
how do you attract people, how do you enchant people in a very unique way that makes you different from everybody else?
I mean, but when you say you mean you as a social media consultant, not as a
Yes, as a consumer. Exactly. As a social media consultant.
Well, I mean, this is kind of a duh-ism, but the way you do it, I think it's word of mouth from your other clients. I don't know any other way. And, you know, the most powerful thing is for, you know, one restaurant in Puerto Rico to tell another restaurant that, wow, you know, she really drove traffic into our restaurant. So, you know, it's kind of a duh-ism, but, you know, the way to be successful is to be successful. And it's easier said than done, but I don't believe in all this kind of SEO black magic and all this kind of stuff. Basically, you have to have a good product and you have to market it.
Exactly.
And now, certainly there are smarter ways to market things, right? So, you know, for example, on Facebook, you know, on your fan page and on Twitter, well, first of all, you have to decide Twitter or Facebook or Google+. You know, which is the best for your client? And I tell you, for different clients, it's different things. Like, I'm going to make this up as I go along, all right? But not that I ever not do that, but if your client is a restaurant, I would say probably Twitter is the best social media promotional tool for you, because, you know, as a restaurant, you can tweet out Wednesday night special, you know, margaritas are free for women or whatever it is, right? And so you can blast that out. It's kind of an advertising medium that you control. It's fast, free, and ubiquitous. So for restaurant Twitter, for a person who wants to build up a consultancy, a expertise in something, I would say it's Google+, that you can have, you can engage in conversations, you can show your expertise because of the better threading of Google+. Let's say you were a photographer. So with a photographer, I think the best medium is probably Google Plus. You show pictures. I see you have kids. So you show pictures, you discuss, you show photo shoots, you do that kind of stuff. Now, Facebook, I think Facebook is best for an organization where you want to create a community of people. And this might not be a restaurant, it might not be a standalone wedding photographer, but it's a company, or it's an association, or it's a school, and where there would be critical mass of people coming in and out, and you can run a photo contest, amongst the fans, and you can have quizzes, and you can have, digital content that you can pass out, and people can post their pictures as opposed to the photographer posting his own pictures. So I think there are different tools and different methods to each of these depending on your client.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that.
All right. Thanks very much for all of your questions. That is all the time we have for questions today. Guy, I want to give you a chance to leave us with some closing thoughts today as well.
Yes. Well, first of all, I think my primary closing thought is Steve Jobs, this is a huge loss, I would say, to humanity. He has done so much for the world in terms of inspiring people, in terms of increasing people's expectations of what technology can do, increasing people's expectations of what people can do. He has truly, truly changed the world. And, I doubt there'll ever be another Steve Jobs. So, wow. As I said, may he rest in peace, but talk about people who have changed the world. And he certainly changed my life. So that's number one. As far as social media, I'm sorry we didn't get into the nuts and bolts of Facebook. I was all prepared to do that, but I don't know. It was just a little strange to do that, just after you found out that Steve Jobs had passed away. So I'll give you the crux of the matter, with social media and enchantment. Remember, the pillars of enchantment are likability, trustworthiness, and quality. Think of the likability of the Apple employee. Think of the trustworthiness of the Genius Bar employee. Think of the quality of the iPhone, iPod, iPad. Other examples, think of the trustworthiness of Zappos, where millions of women buy shoes without trying them on. Think of the likability of Richard Branson. The first time I met him in Moscow, he asked me if I flew on Virgin. I said no, so he got on his knees and started polishing my shoes with his coat jacket. That kind of likability. And if you are likable, trustworthy, and you have a great product, social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus can amplify that message. But it starts with a good reality. Again, it's not putting lipstick on a pig. So you have to start with a good reality. And then social media, Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus, can amplify it, can spread that message, and can make you very, very successful and very enchanting.
All right. Thank you very much, Guy Kawasaki. And thank you, everyone. I have to say my chat window is absolutely flooded with beautiful comments and sentiments expressed towards Steve Jobs' family and Guy, including one person who said, please let Guy know how brave he is to come online. I am truly in awe and enchanted by his courage.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you, everyone, for attending today. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude this Facebook Success Summit session.